Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This was a 600-point day on the Dow Industrial, split almost evenly, 300 points down and then 300 points up. You know, investors can't really be blamed for not being able to make up their minds because they are getting wildly different signals. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's the 23rd of January today. You know, it's often said that Ben Bernanke is the most powerful economist on the planet, and we're as guilty of that as anybody else. But the truth is that the global economy is a pretty big place, way too big for one guy to handle all by himself. Ideally, everybody who gets to make the big decisions agrees on what needs to be done. But early this morning, it became clear there's a disconnect, that the Fed doesn't necessarily see things the same way everybody else does. Yesterday's big rate cut put pressure on the European Central Bank to follow suit. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports the ECB is looking at a very different set of economic circumstances.
Europeans are enjoying a growing economy and figure they can weather the current financial turmoil better than the U.S. But tumbling global stock prices have traders there clamoring for interest rate cuts. So far, European central bankers show no signs of caving, pointing to inflation that's running around 3% per year. But the U.S., too, is battling inflation, and University of South Carolina business professor Stephen Mann says that didn't prevent the Fed from slashing interest rates yesterday.
It leads one to believe the Federal Reserve here in the United States is more vulnerable to political pressures than their counterparts in Europe.
But in addition to overseeing a more robust economy, the ECB also has a slightly different goal than the Fed, says Ted Truman at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Their mandate is to worry about price stability only. The Federal Reserve mandate is to worry about full employment and price stability. It's fair to say that the Europeans do worry about full employment. They just don't say they do.
Still, Peter Kennan with the Council on Foreign Relations says the ECB may be too focused on fighting inflation.
I am a bit concerned that the ECB could be getting behind the curve. They continue to say that the European economy is strong, but there are signs of weakening.
Kennan says the ECB, like the Federal Reserve, is in a tough spot. It must fight inflation, but also give people and companies incentives to borrow and spend. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
For the record, it was European markets down, Asian markets up today for keeping track. And as I mentioned, there was a big afternoon rally on Wall Street. For that, you can credit the good offices of the New York State Insurance Commissioner. The quick and dirty backstory goes something like this. There have been worries the companies that insure the bond investments made by big Wall Street banks might themselves go belly up. No insurance, of course, means no way to make good on those investments if push does ever come to shove. Word out of New York today is that nobody is going to let that happen. Down in Washington, the Congressional Budget Office announced the deficit for fiscal 2008 is going to hit almost $220 billion, and that doesn't count war spending or an economic stimulus package. Daniel Carson reports.
The deficit seemed like an afterthought in the face of the negotiations over a stimulus plan to pump at least $140 billion into consumer and business spending. But John Irons with the Economic Policy Institute says that's okay.
In order to get the stimulus to work effectively, it's going to have to increase the deficit.
Irons says the current deficit isn't going to break the bank.
The most important thing is to try to goose the economy a little bit. So the stimulus proposal in the neighborhood of 1% of GDP seems like a necessary addition to the deficit at this point.
In fact, Doug Elmendorf with the Brookings Institution says shrinking the shortfall now would be counterproductive.
Right now, we should not worry about the long-run budget problems to prevent us from taking the right sort of fiscal stimulus. After we get through this problem, then we should return to the long-run problem.
Analysts say the key is to make the stimulus measures temporary, because anything long-term would worsen the budget outlook. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace.
On that stimulus plan, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson had breakfast with congressional leaders today to start hashing out the details. Commentator Robert Reich says whatever they do, it almost doesn't matter.
Even if the Fed's rate cut was larger, it still wouldn't be enough. And even if a stimulus package could be enacted soon and focused on lower-income Americans who are more likely than the wealthy to spend any extra money, it still would be too little and too late. You see, falling home prices are almost bound to trump whatever boost a rate cut or stimulus package might deliver. Homes are the biggest assets Americans own. They're golden geese for retirement and piggy banks for home equity loans and refinancing. So as home prices fall, people not only feel poorer, they are poorer. And that means they can't spend nearly as much, even if interest rates drop another 0.5% or the government drops a few $100 in their laps. And as consumption lags, companies have to reduce production and cut payrolls. According to a recent estimate by Merrill Lynch, the hit to consumer spending this year and next due to the housing slump will be $360 billion. That's more than double the size of the stimulus package the president or any leading Democrat is talking about. How much worse can it get? Lots. The housing bubble pushed home prices up 20 to 40% above historic averages relative to earnings and rents. Now that the bubble is bursting, expect prices to drop by roughly the same amount and new home construction to contract. It plunged last month to its lowest point in more than 16 years. A sensible stimulus combined with Fed rate cuts can't hurt, but they won't be enough. As a practical matter, our only real hope for avoiding recession or worse depends on more loans and investments from abroad, combined with export earnings as the dollar continues to weaken. In other words, as humbling as it may be to admit, we need the rest of the world to bail us out.
Robert Reich was once the Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. He is now a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. It was indeed a crazy day on Wall Street. Here's just one indicator to tide you over until we get there. Apple started the year as a $200 stock. Closed this afternoon at $139 a share. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Neither politics nor economics are zero-sum games. There is usually a little something for everybody to be found in both disciplines. But that may not be true in the presidential race. Democratic and Republican hopefuls are suddenly focusing on all things fiscal, as are many voters, which could mean good fortune for some candidates and tough times for others, as Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Call it the 401k effect. Polls in Florida and California say voters put money matters at the top of their list of concerns.
6 months ago, it was Iraq around the clock. Now it's all about the economy, stupid.
Larry Sabato directs the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. He says all the candidates will have to address our economic difficulties in the primaries, and that could give some an edge over others, says Politico's David Mark.
I think the biggest beneficiary is Mitt Romney.
Mark points out Romney made his fortune as a venture capitalist. He says the Massachusetts governor shines when he talks about economic issues. Mark says Rudy Giuliani is in a strong position because he can point to a history of cutting taxes.
I cut taxes 23 times when I was mayor of New York City.
Mark says the focus on the economy could hurt John McCain, who voted against Bush's tax cuts, and Mike Huckabee, who raised taxes as governor of Arkansas. On the Democratic side, Mark says listen to Hillary Clinton, who is cashing in on her husband's economic record.
We don't have to go back very far in our history, in fact, just to the 1990s, to see what happens when we do have a fiscally responsible budget.
Mark says Barack Obama and John Edwards aren't as clear-cut on the economy, but he says both may benefit from sounding a populist note.
It's middle-income people, folks who are trying to pay their mortgage, who have maybe a couple kids, they're trying to get through college. Those are the people that may be most receptive to the Democratic message.
Come November, a sour economy could give the Democrats an edge. The Center for Politics' Larry Sabato says historically, tough times have spelled victory for the challenging party. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
If the presidential candidates are addressing your concerns, and especially if they're not, tell us about it. Go to Marketplace.org. Click on Election 2008. Next time you get a chance, sneak a peek at the woman in the office next door or the guy who's got the cube over on the other side of the divider. They might do similar jobs to yours, work the same hours, maybe they even have the same title. But they might have a different arrangement with the company, full-time staffers who aren't really on staff. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli looks at a growing part of the workforce.
Matt Wilcox was excited when he landed a gig as a copywriter at an ad agency in Vermont. Then he heard the terms.
They said, we'd like to hire you on a permalance basis, which means you will work full-time and we'll pay you a salary, but we're going to consider you a freelancer. In every measurable sense, I was full-time, except I had the title of permalancer.
Which meant he didn't get as many benefits, and he's much easier to fire, unlike his coworkers who had staff jobs and more protection. Welcome to the new face of the impermanent American workforce. 14 million people and growing. Rising health care costs and an elastic demand for labor mean businesses want people to work full-time without having to make any real commitments to them. Labor experts say you see this trend in every kind of work, from security guards and janitors to city planners and college professors.
So it really runs the gamut across the economy.
That's Kathy Ruckelshaus of the National Employment Law Project. She says, of course, there's a simple reason employers like this deal, money.
There's huge savings that employers enjoy by constructing these structures. They save a lot on health insurance. They can also save on workers' comp insurance. They can save on unemployment insurance. They can save on a lot of workplace protection and benefits laws that only pertain to employees.
Some permalancers do get benefits, although they tend to be less extensive than their coworkers who are on staff. When media giant Viacom tried to reduce health coverage and yank paid vacation days for its permalancers at MTV this past December, the permalancers went on a well-publicized strike.
And it's just not fair to call us freelancers when we're doing full-time work and to not provide us with the full-time benefits.
As a result, Viacom said it might convert some of the permalancers to full-time staff and would reconsider the benefits cut. Something similar happened at Microsoft. Late in the year 2000, the software giant agreed to pay $97 million to settle a class action lawsuit brought by thousands of workers employed as permatemps. They were angry they didn't get the benefits that staffers received.
The workers that worked and built the buildings at Microsoft had better benefits than the contractors that were making the products.
That's Marcus Courtney with WashTech, an alliance formed a decade ago by Microsoft contract workers. He says since the Microsoft case, the number of permalancers has grown.
It's not illegal. It's for companies to hire permalancers and pay them lower wages and fewer benefits than a direct employee.
Courtney says to stay within the letter of the law, many companies lay off permalancers every so often to show they aren't full-time employees. Sarah Horowitz founded the Freelancers Union. It's an advocacy group for independent workers that lets them buy insurance that they can't get at their jobs. Over the past 5 years, her membership has grown. She says we have to accept that permalancing is here to stay.
Look, this really is the new reality. People are going to be working short term. We're not going back. But we have to start having it so that there's a way that people can be economically secure in this.
As for the ad copywriter Matt Wilcox, he found out just how insecure permalancing can be. Right after the new year, after 3 months at the ad agency, he was told there wasn't enough work and that his job was over that day. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Coming up, every day is a surprise when you're working in Shanghai.
And China is fascinating and interesting and addicting for that reason.
But first, let's do the numbers. The stock market snapped a five-day losing streak with a dramatic rally today, the biggest in almost 2 months. The Dow surged by 2.5%, 298 points to finish at 12,270. The Nasdaq managed a 1% lift, 24 points, wrapped up at 2316. The S&P 500 climbed back by 2.1%, 28 points, closed at 1338. Investors were cheered by word that regulators are looking for ways to improve credit conditions by stabilizing the bond insurance business, as I mentioned. Stocks in bond insurance insurance provider Ambac vaulted almost 72%, while MBIA share shot up 32%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.62%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for the month of December. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is scheduled to address health advocates from around the country at the Families USA Health Action Conference. And the Senate Foreign Relations Committee holds a hearing on international climate change negotiations. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. No matter how it may sound here and elsewhere, the business news this week isn't all stock markets and interest rates. Recession fears are driving oil prices lower. Crude closed under $87 a barrel today. And I can think of two industries that'll be happy to hear that off the top of my head. A couple of major airlines reported profits today. Delta finished 2007, $105 million in the red, that after spending more than $1 billion on jet fuel. Southwest wound up $100 million in the black because it was smart enough to buy its gas ahead of time. The fight for the top spot in the global auto industry might come down to as few as 3,000 cars. Micheline Maynard covers Detroit for the New York Times.
Toyota said that they sold 9.37 million vehicles. GM said that they sold 9.369 million vehicles. It almost seems like this is a tie.
Contractors that worked on Boston's Big Dig have agreed to pay more than $450 million to settle a whole raft of lawsuits. The money will cover design flaws and leaks in some of the tunnels. The family of a woman who was killed in a tunnel ceiling collapse about a year and a half ago has filed separate suits. Back here in L.A., striking screenwriters and producers announced they will start talking again, at least informally. And Starbucks is doing its bit to help out in a slowing economy. Folks pinching their pennies up in Seattle can continue their coffee habit for only a buck a day. The company has announced a trial run of a new 8-ounce cup with unlimited refills, which sounds great to Los Angeles Starbucks customer Carlos Huiza.
Why not? A buck? Who can beat that?
Nobody, probably. But pity this San Francisco barista.
That makes it slightly more annoying if people come up, like, take a gulp, because it's only, like, 8 ounces. If they down it, and then they come back, and then they down it, and then they come back.
And they down it, and they come back. It's ugly out there in the coffee wars. McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts are brewing up their own plans to defeat Starbucks. Starbucks' stock price, by the way, is off 7% since the beginning of this year. Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip went on a buying spree today, not in Gaza itself, where the economy's been at a standstill for months now. This morning, masked gunmen blew more than a dozen holes in the wall separating Gaza from Egypt. The United Nations says as many as 350,000 Palestinians crossed the border to buy supplies. Wire reports had them bringing back everything from televisions to car tires. We've reached economist Yusuf Daoud in the West Bank. He's been working with the Palestinian Monetary Authority. And Professor Daoud, what do Palestinians need the most?
As a matter of fact, some of them needed to get food, some of them needed fuel, others needed cigarettes, others needed communication equipment. And I heard that a printer cartridge was selling for something like $75 in Gaza. So things were in their short supply for this period. Something went down in prices. The agricultural produce, which Gaza was famous for exporting, its prices tumbled down greatly, making the problem even more severe, because when food prices went down, the things that they export, they had less purchasing power, of course.
I'm a little curious, though, where residents of Gaza might be getting money to buy things. The economy there has been almost shut down for a while.
Well, work working at the Monetary Authority allowed me to get some information, which is, you know, there are still some government employees in Gaza who have been receiving salaries. So banks were transferring some money still to Gaza for people who work for the government.
What about the price differentials between, say, a pack of cigarettes in Gaza and what it might go for over the border in at the Rafah crossing today?
I think somewhere along the lines of 30 to 50% higher in Gaza, depending on the kind of good you're talking about.
Would you be worried at all about a black market in Gaza and this situation making it worse? That is, you could go and buy a bag of cement over the border and bring it back in and sell it for two, three, four times what it might be worth?
That has happened. As a matter of fact, today one person went in three times to buy cigarettes, and he said he made his month's salary today.
How much of a boost do you think this this day's events will give to the Gazan economy? Might it make it more durable and able to last just a little bit longer?
Well, I still have hope in the international community because this is a humanitarian situation. And even if it does sustain for a day or two, that is not, and it doesn't get us very far. Israel still announces that it will keep its checkpoints closed to trade and labor movements, and therefore the situation is going to continue to be bad in Gaza.
What will happen if the border does stay open as far as the Gazan economy goes?
It will make a severe problem less severe. At least in this cold weather, people will not be, and the hospitals will need the energy for people not to die, because people in the dialysis units, you know, those people who go clean their blood, others who need certain kinds for breathing, who has asthma, this medicine was running out. So at least this will make a bad situation less bad. But I don't know for how long.
Youssef Daoud is a professor of economics at Birzeit University in the West Bank city of Ramallah. Professor, thank you.
Thank you very much.
No matter how bad your commute is, how many hours you spend sitting in traffic or stuck on a crowded subway car, just be thankful you work where you do and not in Shanghai. Our China correspondent Scott Tong says his trip to and from the office is kind of a metaphor for doing business there.
Bye, Daddy.
The morning starts out nicely enough. Get dropped off at the subway, down the stairs, through the turnstiles. On the platform, the nice lady on the recording reminds me, and 20 million others, to act civilized. Let folks off the train before you get on. Ah, if it only worked that way. The train comes and people just charge each other. It sounds Darwinian, every man for himself. But cultural critic Zhu Dake says China's tumultuous history explains a lot.
When the communists took over in 1949, Beijing abandoned China's core value, civility. Then the Cultural Revolution promoted violence against enemies. So don't blame the people for their behavior. They're victims.
One writer calls China 1 billion survivors, white-collar and blue-collar survivors. And today it feels like all of them are on my train.
As Americans, our personal space is measured in, you know, 18 inches or I can't remember what it is.
China veteran Kent Kettle is a business consultant.
Here it's nanometers or something, micrometers or zero.
Kettle says there's a limited pie mentality here. People know it's a unique moment for China. Economic opportunity and jobs and deals, and they're all scrambling for a slice. And if you're a businessman who thrives on this adrenaline, then chaos is part of the draw of China.
No other place in the world can I go home at night and think to myself, something happened today that I have never seen before in my life. And China is fascinating and interesting and addicting for that reason.
Next stop is West Nanjing Road.
Two more stops. Time to plot my exit strategy. To get to the door, the unwritten rule here is to physically push people aside without even saying, excuse me. I'm out, walking fast, approaching the escalator. And then, unexpectedly, everything stops. A commuter is just standing in the middle of the escalator, clogging up all the walkers. And then at the top, another guy stops to make a cell phone call, so the rest of us have to maneuver around him. On the street, I detour again, around four leisurely co-workers who occupy the entire sidewalk. Getting frustrated. What to do? Well, my friend Martin Jennet at a Danish shipping company used to employ the get-even approach.
I would walk really close to these guys with my elbows out and just on purpose hit them, you know, just to let them think. Not anymore.
But he says confrontation doesn't get results here, either on the street or, in his case, negotiating with a state-owned shipping company. It just can't force change on your terms.
So it's either I accept the way things are, or I move, I go out, I go home.
Or you go native. Take the office elevator, my last obstacle. There's always a backup in the morning. And over time, I've learned that you have to jostle for position. Otherwise, you never get on. Kent Kettle says driving works the same way.
When I first got to China, I didn't know how to merge into traffic. And I finally realized it was like, you know, Ray Charles behind the wheel. You can't look, and you just hit the gas and go.
His point is, it's a sink or swim, save yourself kind of economy, and you can sense it on the street. As one businessman put it, if we in the West get beat, it's because the Chinese have out-hustled us. Better get to work. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note to follow up on something we mentioned yesterday. After 10 years and who knows how much stuff sold online, Meg Whitman is officially stepping down as the CEO of eBay. No long goodbyes for her. March 31st will be her last day. The announcement helped the company bury some troubling earnings news today. eBay finished 2007 on a high note, more than $500 million in profit. But it did say this quarter and this year won't be anywhere near as good. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. On a day that saw quite a turnaround in New York, the Dow rose 298 points today, 2.5%. Financials did most of that, the big Wall Street banks. The NASDAQ gained 24 points, 1%. The S&P 500 added 28 points. That is 2.1% there. We've got a podcast if you missed something on the radio today. Go to our website, marketplace.org. You'll find the link there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. And coming up next time, it's Buy, Sell, and Watch. A new cable channel follows some big money traders.
I'm sure the Wall Streeters like the fact that we're making a show about them. They are a pretty vain crowd.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.